It's Wednesday, September 15th, and California's true colors are still deep shades of blue. We start here. With a blowout victory, Gavin Newsom holds on to his governorship.
It appears we are enjoying an overwhelmingly no vote tonight here in the state of California.
And he did it with two things Democrats are most scared of, the coronavirus and Donald Trump. We'll break down the results. Doctors aren't just asking for more hospital beds, they're asking for smaller ones.
We had to pause admitting patients to the hospital because we couldn't find rooms.
With youngsters flooding emergency rooms, we'll go to a state suffering from back-to-school jitters. And the pandemic made us poorer, so why did fewer people go into poverty?
That's 5.5 million people who were lifted out of poverty that now face the risk of poverty again.
A coronanomics might affect how your lawmakers vote. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. It was considered a joke until suddenly it wasn't a joke at all.
As ballots are being sent out to every registered voter across California, polls show Governor Gavin Newsom locked in a tight race for next month's recall election.
An effort to recall California's Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom made its way to a vote in recent weeks. And once your job is on the ballot, you have to clear 50%. 50% of voters saying yes, remove the governor and you're out. 50% say no, don't remove him, you get to stay. Well, 50% is kind of a tough bar to clear for any sitting official. President Biden's approvals already dropped below 50%.
Get rid of this governor who's done nothing but bad stuff for the state.
I want to see new leadership. I don't think he put the kids first for the whole entire year.
Will Governor Gavin Newsom survive? Just hours left as that state votes.
So as the votes came in last night, there was the sense that anything could happen in the nation's most populous state.
A pretty small amount of votes have yet been counted. The no's are in the lead by a pretty wide margin, 72-28%. But that is a very small number of votes.
It's still just 806.
But less than an hour after polls closed last night, we learned that Gavin Newsom has survived.
It appears we are enjoying an overwhelmingly no vote tonight here in the state of California.
There's still more questions to be asked, so let's take you straight to Southern California this morning, where ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman is based. Matt, what put Newsom over the top?
Larry Elder put Newsom over the top. Larry Elder was the prime opponent, conservative talk show host who has been likened to a Trump clone by President Biden, by Gavin Newsom and others, and says that, you know, Trump's election 2016 was basically God sent.
You told CNN about shenanigans so far in this race. Do you believe that there
So many people are going to vote to recall this man. I don't think we're going to have to worry about the result of this election.
So he was in many ways the perfect foil. And the fact that at some point over the summer, probably in August, Democrats started to pay attention to this.
What do we have to do? Vote no. What do we have to do?
The Democratic machine rolled into action. Gavin Newsom raised $70 million for his campaign.
He's the clone of Donald Trump. Can you imagine him being governor of this state?
And people started getting those mail-in ballots to their mailboxes, which is how every registered active voter in California gets them these days, and they started voting.
I want California to not have this Republican takeover happen.
I believe in women's rights very strongly, and I don't want something like Texas to occur here.
So. And now we're seeing this resounding victory. Like, just to put this in context, Gavin Newsom won his governorship with 62% of the vote in 2018, and it seems that he's going to get an overwhelming majority of votes for no, which means keep him in office, very likely significantly higher than what he won in the 2018 race for governor, where he got 62%.
Wow. And so what does this mean for California then, Matt? Is just status quo, everyone, like, just do your job as normal, everyone acts like this never happened?
Yeah, minus the $276 million in taxpayer money that was spent to have these recall elections. But yes, essentially status quo ante. He's still the governor. Nothing changes for him.
And so I'm humbled and grateful to the millions and millions of Californians that exercised their fundamental right.
He runs again in 2022, we think. And we think, at least Larry Elder has hinted, that he is going to be his opponent in 2022 for the GOP.
Let's be gracious. Let's be gracious in defeat. And by the way, we may have lost the battle, but we are going to win the war.
Is the real legacy then, Matt? I wonder, is the real legacy of this going to be the reaction to it from conservatives, from the right wing? Because the idea among a lot of Trump supporters, including President Trump himself, that because Larry Elder lost here, even though it's a solidly blue state, even though he's a far right radio host, barely polling 20%, you know, as far as people who wanted to vote for him here, even with this decisive result, that somehow this result can't possibly be legitimate. Is that going to be the thing that we're all talking about for the next several days?
Yeah, I do think that the legacy is going to be rising concern of voter fraud and rising concern about concern of voter fraud.
How many years have you been doing elections?
Almost 2 decades.
Has there ever been this much scrutiny about the process?
Yeah, I mean, I keep thinking that the next year will have less scrutiny, but it just keeps growing.
We're at the Orange County Election Headquarters. They're processing probably about almost 900,000 votes. And we noticed a really large number of sheriff's deputies, and we assumed that they were here to protect the ballots, to protect the integrity of this vote. But the registrar disabused us of that by telling us that, no, they're actually here to protect the election workers.
I think it's becoming a troublesome narrative, as I mentioned. And I will tell you that any election official that tells you that fraud is not on our mind and we're not looking at those things has their head in the sand.
So much has the tension risen over election fraud that they apparently have credible threats about being attacked just for working in the elections and processing ballots. They're not making policy. So, yeah, that is the rising concern, that every time it seems that a Republican candidate might be losing an election, they will preemptively begin to claim fraud, thereby really weakening the very institution that they're vying for, you know, in this democracy. So there's a major concern about that, especially from the people like the California Secretary of State and the registrar here, the people who actually do the elections and run them. They are very concerned about this trend.
Right, which is why it was so notable that before the election, before votes have been counted, Larry Elder was talking about the election being rigged. Did not seem to backtrack that with our own Zorin Shah, but something's changed where last night he did go ahead and admit defeat to his supporters. Matt Gutman, there in Orange County, California. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, we can argue over who should get vaccinated, but what about people who can't? COVID falls in with a new crowd of friends after the break.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
At this point, the CDC data are clear. If you take 10 Americans in a hospital with COVID right now, chances are 9 of those 10 people are unvaccinated. Like, it's not close. The vaccines are the single thing keeping this surge of cases nationwide from actually being way, way more deadly. And the more the Delta variant spreads, the more unvaccinated people will be at risk. To which some people say, then great, that's up to you. You can get vaccinated, you can let me do my own thing. Except remember, there are people in this country who literally cannot get vaccinated. They're called children.
Nearly 252,000 new cases reported in just the last week, the biggest weekly increase we've ever seen. A quarter of all new cases in this country now in children.
For much of the year, parents have been trying to keep their kids safe from the coronavirus, despite kids under 12 not being eligible for the vaccines. Well, yesterday, we got some clarity on when those shots might be approved.
We expect to have that data by the end of September, and then we would expect to file that with the FDA in early October for a potential EUA.
Pfizer has been conducting trials for its vaccine among children and says it could be able to submit its data in early October, first for 5 to 12-year-olds, then for kids under 5. Then Dr. Anthony Fauci suggested the FDA could even turn right around and approve these drugs within weeks.
It is very likely that vaccines will be available
down to 5 or 6 years old as we get into October and early November.
But to parents watching kids get sick in increasing numbers, a few weeks feels like a lifetime. Because we now live in a world where, contrary to everything you'd heard about kids and COVID last year, children are now making up about a quarter of new cases. Dr. Adam Mezoff is the chief medical officer for Dayton Children's Hospital. Dr. Mezoff, I'm wondering, how many COVID patients did you start this surge with, and how many do you have now?
Yes. As an example, at the first part of the pandemic, it would be rare for us to have a child in the hospital with COVID, although we did. In August, we had one patient in the hospital on average. In the last 2 to 3 weeks, we have 12 to 15 patients in the hospital on an average day. Our ICU census has sometimes had up to 40% of their patients as COVID, although it's usually about 20% of their patients.
Which does not sound like a ton of people in the hospital, like 12 or 15 kids. But when you compare it to one or two, the percentage change, if you extrapolate that across a lot of hospitals, is staggering. So what is changing? Is it just schools are open? That's it?
I think part of the explanation is you have to put it in the context of the current circumstances. And let me tell you what I mean by that. We've described this almost as a perfect storm.
Concern for so many parents across this country as millions of children head back to school.
So we have a dramatic increase in the amount of COVID that's happening in children.
At least 45 school districts with more than 40,000 students have shut down in-person learning because of COVID infections.
Although last year this wasn't the case, this year we are definitely seeing COVID being transmitted within schools. Last year, we're vigorous about our masking. This year, there haven't been as many mandates for masking.
In Texas, where the governor has banned mask mandates in schools, a record number of children hospitalized with COVID.
I think because of how vigorous we were with masking, we in some ways protected ourselves from some of the common respiratory viruses we've typically seen.
These include the common cold, influenza, and respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, a respiratory illness that can cause pneumonia in infants.
And those viruses usually come in the winter. They are now coming right now in numbers we haven't even seen in the winter.
Everyone was on lockdown, so the immunity that they would have gotten from these common viruses did not happen, so they remain very susceptible to all of these viruses.
So this morning, we had to pause admitting patients to the hospital because we couldn't find rooms. So that meant patients had to stay in the emergency room temporarily while we figured out where we could put them. We have 6 children's hospitals in the state of Ohio. Every one of them is in the same circumstance.
Wow. And so what does that look like on the hospital floor? I mean, is that the stories we hear from adults about ventilators and everything, is that what these kids are facing? Or it's we're so used to hearing that it's not as serious for children.
It is less common to get children with serious illness.
When Misty took her daughter to the urgent care, she was diagnosed with COVID-19, pneumonia, and respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV.
When she started coughing up blood in her phlegm, I was like, no, that's enough. And that's when we went to the hospital.
But I was talking to my colleagues at Nationwide Children's today, and I believe they have a half a dozen children on ventilators because of COVID.
You're just sitting there watching her. Like, you can't do nothing to fix it.
So again, the first part of the pandemic, that was not something anybody thought of or really was reporting. Kids are getting sick like adults are getting sick. Maybe not in the same numbers, but the severity is incredible.
This virus don't care. It's going to hit who it can hit, and it's going to just keep going.
What's that like for your staff, then? What's that like for these people who are interacting with patients and parents? We've heard about people even arguing over whether they or their kid has COVID in the first place. What's it like to, I don't know, to look around the hospital floor right now?
It's taking a great toll. We have incredibly dedicated doctors, nurses, respiratory therapists, people who clean rooms. The people who work here are here because they care about children and keeping children healthy and safe.
This is the fourth night this week I've been on call, and it's been a long week.
And there's a frustration that we haven't been able to do that, and because of that, children are suffering.
We have a premature infant in the neonatal ICU on ECMO, which is a heart-lung bypass machine. In our PICU, we have a 23-month-old infant on a high-frequency oscillating ventilator. We've had 4 other teenagers, all unvaccinated, in the unit on various levels of escalating respiratory support.
But maybe I could sort of extend this a little bit for you. So remember that a large number of our employees have children because they tend to be on the younger side as hospital workers. So when their children get sick, those employees can't come to work. So we're facing record number of patients at a time when we're having almost record number of employees either out sick themselves or taking care of family members that have gotten sick, because this is a pandemic and it is now affecting children dramatically as well as adults.
Last question for you then. You guys think about how much worse this could get? If we're talking about school being one of the major issues here, what are you looking at in the next few weeks?
Well, yes, we're worried. In fact, I've been in pediatrics for 40 years. I know you're going to tell me that I just don't look that old, but yes, indeed, I am. And I have seen a lot of things in my time. I've never seen anything like this. The volumes, the way kids are getting sick. One of the ways we get through this, other than having a lot of really great and dedicated people that work at our hospital, is working with the other hospitals in the state who also have great and dedicated people. And we share best practices, we share supplies when needed, and this is not a territorial thing. There is no competition about this. It's whatever we need to do together, we will do.
And I gotta say, doctor, the bizarre thing about this is we were hearing this from doctors at, you know, major adult hospitals, I guess, this time last year, right?
Exactly,
people saying,
right.
Well, you know, we're really just sharing advice on how to, you know, you flip people over at this time or you vent them at this time or that time, just trying to save lives as best we can. Now we're seeing these same conversations among pediatric doctors. Dr. Adam Mezoff from Dayton Children's Hospital, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now, you heard Dr. Mezoff describe how even hospital staffs are not immune from the toll that this virus can take, not just on their health, but on their jobs. It can throw an entire workforce into disarray.
It's always been the hardest part of running a small business is finding good help. Throw COVID on top of that?
Now it's really a challenge.
And when President Biden announced a nationwide mandate on large companies, one of the reasons this was welcomed by a lot of business leaders was it's really tough to predict anything about the economy as long as we're getting derailed constantly by COVID. And yesterday we got new census data showing just how derailed the average worker was last year. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze covers economics. Elizabeth, from the top line, it seemed like the average American is just poorer than they were at the start of the pandemic, right? Is that the right way to read this?
Hey, Brad. Well, unsurprisingly, that's right. Incomes went down over the past year because of the pandemic, and the official poverty rate, it went up because millions of people lost their jobs, they lost their livelihoods.
I don't know if I'm going to get funds before I get evicted. Am I going to find the job in time before everything else becomes a bigger mess?
What's really fascinating is when you look at this census data and you look at a broader report, you can actually see that poverty went down in 2020 when you factor in other things like stimulus checks and unemployment payments. So the number of people living in poverty in 2020 actually went down at this time when we were living through one of the most kind of severe recessions in history. And that's because of some of the federal aid that went out to Americans over that year.
Consumers, by the way, are sitting now on $1 trillion in cash as a result of not spending a lot during the pandemic and also those multiple rounds of stimulus checks. That's a lot of buying power, which is great news for the economy.
So if you look at the numbers from the Census Bureau, those two stimulus checks that came in 2020, there were two of them throughout the year, those two checks alone, they helped lift 11.7 million people out of poverty, just those stimulus checks. And the expanded unemployment benefits, the Census Bureau says, those kept an additional 5.5 million people from going into poverty. So really, these government programs, this expanded safety net that we saw from the federal government during the pandemic, it was a major contributor to reducing poverty over the past year.
Well, that was last year, right? That's 2020 when we saw two huge stimulus bills pass. One was in the spring, one was in the fall after Election Day, but still under President Trump. Now President Biden's taken over. We've already seen more stimulus, right? With potentially even more spending on the way. So I guess I'm wondering, you know, if people are arguing over these stimuli in Congress, does that mean, should they think that stuff like this is working?
Yeah. I mean, the reality is this data makes the case for an expanded safety net if that's what you're looking for when it comes to reducing poverty. You know, the fact is there was another stimulus check in 2021 that would probably show up in the 2021 census data. And there are other measures that have also been really aimed at trying to help people out, like the expanded child tax credit.
9 million Americans are losing all of their federal benefits. Another 3 million will see their weekly benefits reduced by about $300 per week.
The one thing I'll say, though, is that a lot of these federal programs, like those expanded unemployment benefits, those are now gone. Those have dried up. And, you know, one economist I talked to put it this way. That's 5.5 million people who were lifted out of poverty that now face the risk of poverty again because that program is now gone.
We shouldn't let child poverty continue to stain the conscience or drag down our economy.
And so the fact is here, what we really saw during the pandemic is that this is kind of a policy choice. The government really chose to pursue these policies. And if it continues to do that, it could still have an effect on the bottom line when it comes to poverty.
We're printing money, we're creating government bonds, we're borrowing on unprecedented scales. Those are things that are much more likely to translate themselves into inflation.
But there are also some obvious trade-offs, and that's what's being debated right now in Congress.
Well, and let's talk about some of the economic trade-offs here, right? Because if you were going to, I don't know, tax wealthier Americans to pay for the stimulus checks that went out, that is just like essentially redistributing wealth, right? But that's not what happened, right? Taxes did not go up to pay for all this. Instead, we just printed a lot more money. Isn't the risk of that just a ton of inflation?
This is the risk that everyone talks about in Congress. So far, there are signs of higher inflation. But I've got to say, Brad, it's not necessarily coming from the fact that the government is just printing a lot more money. A lot of the inflation that we're seeing has come from backlogs in supply chains.
Throughout the supply chain, transportation, warehouse costs are rising. We've had weather issues that are also driving down the ability to get the supplies.
Or from this pent-up kind of demand that we saw throughout the summer where people went out and they traveled and they spent money on restaurants.
It's a roller coaster. You go up and you go down. But overall, we're seeing things is coming back slowly.
The latest consumer price index data is a really good example of this. Prices overall, they still went up 5.3% in August compared to a year ago. That's a pretty big increase on a yearly rate. But on a monthly basis, we saw prices go down in a lot of those categories that have been really kind of juiced over the past several months. So, for example, airfare.
Domestic flights are expected to drop by 10% this month, with the average round-trip domestic ticket costing $260. And international fares are already hitting record lows.
Rental car prices, 8.5% lower. Mm. You know, hotel prices were down. Used car prices, something that we've talked about, really driving up inflation. We saw the prices of used cars start to decline. So really, some of those key things that have been driving inflation higher are starting to abate. And that could actually be a reason why eventually, even if more stimulus is passed, it might not necessarily lead to a bunch more inflation. But, you know, we've talked about before, we're in a really unprecedented situation. I hate to use that word. It's used all the time. But the amount of money that's being pumped into the economy, there is no precedent for this. So we're just going to have to keep looking at the data as it comes out every month.
See what you did there. Driving inflation with car sales. All right. Elizabeth Schulze taking out her good vocabulary on the rest of us. Thanks a lot. Have a good one.
Thanks so much, Brad.
Okay, we're going to take another quick break. When we return, in the world of toilet training, the only prescription was more cowbell. One last thing is next.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
And one last thing. Parents will know what I'm talking about when I say potty training ain't easy.
We have been through it once already in our household, and let's be honest, it can stink.
But I'm not talking about potty training for children. I'm talking about cows. A study published this week showed that a group of cows actually learned how to use the toilet faster than your average toddler. They called this the moo-loo. Over 2 weeks, cattle were taught to push open a gate and do their business in a special pen. If they did it, they got some sweet molasses. And since cows apparently have a sweet tooth, eventually 11 out of the 16 were doing this consistently. Kind of spotty results, but not bad. You might be thinking, who cares? What kind of weird party trick is this? But environmental policymakers say this could be a big deal. Cow urine can utterly destroy soil, affect the surrounding ecosystem, and cows release 8 gallons of it per day, meaning the moo-loo could counteract some of that. Now, cow urine isn't actually as harmful as cow farts. The methane produced by their flatulence is one of the biggest concerns of the climate world, but scientists did not train that out of them. As one of the researchers said, without passing gas, cows would literally explode. My team was worried I would make too many cow puns. I said, no effing way. Start here tomorrow. Just hit subscribe. More on all these stories at abcnews.com or the ABC News app. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.